how do we overcome it? Through sabr and patience. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at anxiety in the words of Imam Ali and the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has another new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. He has said that he was not daunted by the scale of the economic challenge, pledging to lead the country through an economic crisis and to rebuild trust in politics. Well, that makes one wonder whether Sunak is really aware of the scale of the economic crisis that the UK is in, from inflation to the cost of living crisis to the political infighting and radical changes in policy that have horrified investors, alarming international allies. Sunak has his hands full. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Sunak has the solutions needed to bring the UK out of this economic and political mess.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials, he definitely has the experience, been there in the as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
We're going to go with our guests. Let me introduce them for this program. Limpet Opec, former member of the British Parliament, joins us from London. Also joining us is Shebri Rizvi, political analyst, who also joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Lampad Opec, taking a look at the soap opera there in the UK with Rishi Sunak, a 42-year-old former hedge fund boss. I picked these out, see what you think. Only been in politics for 7 years, and estimated fortune, £730 million or $830 million. And that is pointing to what many are feeling, that he may not be able to connect with Brits who are feeling inflation or who are in poverty. Obviously, a public that's strained by things that are that have put them into the crisis that they're in right now. Is that accurate?
We shall find out. But you've accurately raised his potential Achilles heel. Let's be honest. For a man who is worth over £700 million, a small increase to him of a couple of £1,000 in energy bills isn't going to be very important. He could almost be regarded as a hobby politician because he isn't going to suffer if the economy does. And so that's the biggest single question. Can he understand what millions of people in the UK are now suffering in terms of finances? The second one is, can he fix it? Liz Truss, in her 44 days in office, managed to trash the British economy. It was already in trouble. Partly because of some idiotic energy policies, but she wrecked it. My estimate is that she has cost mortgage payers in the United Kingdom £80,000 million a year in extra interest rates. I'm one of those people. So can Rishi Sunak really wind back to the clock to a time where we have much more favourable interest rates, and that for a lot of people, paying an extra £8,000 or £10,000 a year is going to make them essentially poor? And then the third and the last point, is he clubbable? By that I mean, can he do what Boris Johnson did very well, which was appeal to individuals who wouldn't normally vote Conservative? But they did this time, and they gave Boris Johnson a big majority. Now, those are three big challenges. Of course, I'm not saying Labour Party could do any better, but they could win by default. If you get, if he doesn't do three out of three of the things I listed there, then two out of three isn't good enough, and that means he could lose the general election. That's what he's going to be judged on by his own party.
Taking a look at his economic agenda there, Shebri Rizvi, what is it? Do you know? Do we know? I mean, at this point, it may be too early to tell.
Hello, good evening. I don't think it's too late, because obviously the Sunak scenario is exactly the same as what the Conservative Party has been practicing for the last 12 years. We are told that it's going to be a difficult time. We have to take bold decisions. At the same time, he needs to fix the economy. What are these bold decisions? Does that mean that further cutting of the healthcare, further cutting of the schools sort of funding, further cutting on other social services in the United Kingdom? So if that's what he means by bold decisions, what I would say the bold decisions would be is to, cap the bonuses of the bankers in London. It would be to increase perhaps the taxation to the highest earners, the 1%. His own cabal, who is in the category of millionaires, should they be paying more? Perhaps a bold decision would be to have a windfall tax on the energy providers. A bold decision on the economy would be to, bring parity for the lower paid earners, i.e., for example, just take one instance, a nurse at the beginning, 12 years ago, when the Conservative Party came into power, is £4,000 less well off than she was 12 years ago. So bold decision would be to bring equal parity to the key workers, nurses, the policemen, the teachers, the care workers. I can go on. Multiple other sort of employees who have really lost out, not just on pay increases not taking place, but due to the inflation, they're actually a lot poorer than they were even 12 exactly. years ago. So bold decision. So as I said, the Sunak scenario doesn't sound any different than what has been practiced for the last 12 years. Yes, of course, the previous prime minister we've had, as you know, three prime ministers in 3 months, and hers was really an experiment to see whether ideological, okay. fundamentalist, right-wing economic policies should be applied to the United Kingdom. And we saw what happened. Perhaps Mr. Sunak, being more clever than Truss, would actually do it more gently, but the end result would be more austerity, poor becoming poorer, and really the belt tightening would be required of the 99%, whilst the 1% really go to the bank all the way laughing.
When you have 17% of an increase in things like food, for example, limpet OPEC, and of course we can talk about the inflation into other sectors, in particular at the top of the list practically would be the energy sector and gas bills. He's got to do something about those two. But the fact that our guest, Shabir Rizvi, talks about income, how it's fallen behind, obviously was behind. Inflation obviously put that in fifth gear in terms of it falling behind even more. There's got to be an impact soon. But that could only be done if you're generating income. Not to get too technical about this, but generating income would then come in through the form of projections in one sense. But in this atmosphere of a war and lack of energy and what we're looking at, which is a recession, which many say the UK is not in one, but it is in a recession, how can he bring in results quickly, which is the I guess the key here?
We are in a recession in any meaningful way. The average citizen, not the millionaires, but the average citizen is feeling a lot poorer. And you've mentioned the three big things here: mortgages, fuel costs, and food costs. Those three are crippling anyone who was just about managing a few months ago. And turning to your question and continuing the debate, it's very hard to see what Rishi Sunak can do quickly without either borrowing even more, and he has borrowed more than any chancellor in the history of Britain, certainly since World War II, or making the kind of cuts that my colleague has just listed. Both of those are very difficult. It's probably easier for him to borrow, but then, of course, the world has just marked down the credibility of British politics and British government because it borrowed so much, at least it was going to under Liz Truss. So what is he to do? He can hope for a miracle, it's not going to come. He can ditch the energy policies, which are based heavily on environmental policies now. Wherever you stand on whether there's a climate crisis or not, Britain can't afford to do this right now. He should ditch net zero, and he should use fracking and domestic oil production to quickly reduce fuel prices. In terms of food prices, they'll then come down a little bit, just because energy is so important. Fuel is such a high percentage of most of the costs in the United Kingdom. But the big one is actually the mortgage situation. If you have a £200,000 mortgage, you're paying £8,000 a year extra every year. That dwarfs the increase in energy costs. What can he do about that? The only thing he can do is get interest rates down. Two ways to do that. One is to convince the Bank of England it can do that. And that's difficult when you've got 10% inflation. Or he could renationalize the Bank of England. That's the radical thing he could do. He could own interest rates, as occurred for decades, for pretty much a century in the UK, before a gesture of virtue signaling, the Labour Party said, no, you go off and set the interest rates independently. But as you can see from that list, it's a really difficult thing for Rishi Sunak to deliver. And probably it's going to get worse rather than get better. He's going to have a winter of discontent.
We need to understand, Shabir Rizvi, if you can, with the short amount of time that we have, as to what and why, I should say, the UK is in the position that it is in terms of its economy, which is cited to be one of the worst of the G7 countries, not just because of the pandemic, but prior to that. And maybe even some saying as far back as the 2007-08 financial crisis when it hit, maybe the UK was not able to truly recover, and it was just dragging itself along with GDP increases that were not that noteworthy. Are we looking at that far back when it comes to the UK economy dragging its feet and not doing well? And then, of course, then you got COVID, and then you got the Ukraine conflict, and here we are.
Well, indeed, one has to look back over the last 12 years, and I have quite often pointed this out in our conversations on this matter, is that the financial crisis that hit the world in 2008, and of course it hit USA, the European Union, then we had what is called quantitative easing, literally government buying their own security, printing of money, all kinds of things. But then we had a Conservative Party came into power soon after in 2010. And they practice really an ideologically based economic policy of austerity. This is usually what the IMF sort of prescribes to developing world wherever there's economic issues. They say that, you know, have austerity, sort of increase this, do less social welfare issues that impact the majority of the public. That kind of formula was applied not at the behest of the IMF, but really the government, which was ideologically based and wanting to really continue the practice of very sort of monetarist approach to the British economy. And here we have 12 years later, yes, you know, the mantra in the UK is even when the former Prime Minister Truss was leaving, she said, Putin. But really, look, you know, the war in Ukraine may have some impact here. And the reality is that we are sort of burning money by supplying armaments to the Ukrainians. That will, of course, have an impact on the UK. Yes, we have sort of sanctioned Russia. Therefore, the oil and gas are not coming on the market, hence increasing the energy price. But the reality is that the Conservative Party needs to abandon its ideologically based economic policies. They really don't have much left in the fiscal armory to do. Yes, we've got the Chancellor who's going to be announcing his budget on 31st of October, an ominous day, Halloween, you know, which is the sign of sort of coming out of summer into the dark days of winter. Perhaps Britain is moving into the dark days of winter, whilst we haven't had a very bright summer either.
Well, to use your words, dark days of winter is what I think we're looking at. Lempidopic, if you agree, where there has been predictions made by, I think, the UK electric power grid, that there may be three-hour outages in electricity. So let's take a little bit of a break, Lempidopic, if we can, from the economic aspects of Rishi Sunak and the challenges he faces there, and how he needs to get his party together. Based on the report that we just saw by Rob Carter, the Conservative Party's popularity is really lagging behind the Labour, and it has dropped quite dramatically. And there's, of course, talks of infighting within the party. How much of a challenge does that pose for Sunak, even though he is picking, I guess, new cabinet members, and a reshuffle is on the way from what we understand?
It's in process now. You mentioned the pending power cuts, which Rishi Sunak himself warned would happen. Well, the lights are going off on the popularity of the Conservative Party, and you could say that Liz Truss was massively instrumental in putting the Conservative Party 30 percentage points behind Labour. It's not because I think that Keir Starmer's doing a particularly good job. I think he's a rather poor opposition leader. But by default, the Conservatives are so unpopular that people go to Labour thinking, well, anyone but the Conservatives. And Boris Johnson didn't help either. What can he do is the question you asked me. What he can do is a good job of the economy. He can stop those power cuts, because if the power cuts come, everyone will remember, at least people of my age, will remember the winter of discontent, as it was called in 1978 and 1979, a line which Margaret Thatcher, a Tory opposition leader, went on to be Prime Minister, used against Labour. Well, they'll get that thrown right back in their face. Internally, he also has problems, because some people still blame Rishi Sunak for the demise of Boris Johnson's premiership. And because there wasn't an election, let's remember, Rishi Sunak was not elected prime minister. He was appointed by minister by default. That means there's that discontent in the party too. Can he pull it back? Not without some luck. He needs to be lucky that there aren't power cuts, because that will really put the lights out on popularity of the Labour, of the Tories, right up to the next election. And he needs to be lucky with party discipline, because there isn't much of that either at the moment. It remains to be seen if he has the leadership to do those things. For the sake of my own quality of life, I hope he does. But there's an awful lot of doubt. And Rishi Sunak, if he makes it to the election, well and good. If he gets deposed, there will be a general election, because the Conservative Party is almost torn apart as it is.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have to get back into the economy again here, Shabbir Rizvi, based on how things are going. But an important stat that I brought up before coming on, and I'm curious as to whether the general public there in the UK even, or the wider world, actually is aware of the fact that more than one in five of the UK population, which is 22%, actually live in poverty. I mean, that's quite a stat, almost a quarter. So if we're looking at that particular stat, all indications are at this point, if this, if the UK is going on the track that it is, that that's going to increase. There needs to be something that bridges the UK finances in order to be able to increase people's livelihoods. And that, I'm talking very generally now, so that people don't have to suffer as much, whether it's, as Lambert Opik said, the big three, like mortgages or food or other things, the social services perhaps. That the big question is, where is that money going to come from? I mean, he can't tax his way into generating income. That usually doesn't work, if I'm correct to say that. How do you think he should approach it?
Well, there are possibilities of what you're saying, that yes, one in five have huge difficulties. And also, we have on a daily basis 5 million people going to the food banks. So there are a whole host of issues as far as economics is concerned. But the reality is that politics impinges on economics, and economics impinges on politics, if you like. There's two sides of the same coin. And if the political situation is not stable, and the Conservative Party carries on in this way, and I was only reading today before coming on to this interview, is that there are some Conservative Party members who are in the Boris brand, if you like, are already sort of jockeying to get rid of Sunak. And it is said that perhaps he might not last until Christmas. So that's perhaps another development that's taking place, and we'll see what happens. But his really big challenge, as our other guest has pointed out, is really the economic issue. And there aren't sort of any silver bullets for him, if you like. Taxing higher, will that generate enough revenue? Or the thought of growing the economy, as the former previous prime minister kept on saying that she wants to grow the economy. How will they grow the economy? Which sectors of the economy would grow? And then, of course, the whole issue of immigration. Do immigrants, new immigrants coming in, contribute to the growth of the economy? Because of the whole sort of problems and challenges and the sort of maligning of immigrants and asylum seekers in the UK, that again is not an avenue that is open to the UK to bring in new blood, sure, from foreign countries to grow the economy.
Okay. We only have 30 seconds, Lambert Opik. £2.5 billion so far assistance to Ukraine. UK has announced that it will match it for the year 2023. That's £12 million per day. How could the UK afford that?
It's a political necessity for Rishi Sunak. If he looks like he's not going to be sponsoring Ukraine, he'll be accused of weak leadership. The rights and the wrongs of it in military terms and political terms don't matter, except to save his back.
Thank you so much. We're going to have to end in there. Lempit Opik, their former member of the British Parliament from London, and also from London, Shabir Rizvi, political analyst. Thank you to you both. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitapoy and the team. It's goodbye. Until the next program.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Factors of Disclosing Secrets. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the factors of disclosing the secrets of others. We know that Islam gives importance to the secrets and it stops us from spying someone. The only case which is allowed is where you need to prevent your country, your state from the enemies. But otherwise, it is forbidden to spy on the believers, to go after them. Now, there are some factors which are causes of disclosing the secrets amongst the people. And obviously, we must be careful when we are living, when we are socializing with the people. The first factor is when someone is so much talkative. If someone is so much talkative, obviously he talks about everything. He loves to talk and always he can never be like, you know, sit silent. So he always wants something to talk about. And therefore, if he knows a secret, we generally have seen that such people, because of their being talkative, they have leaked the secrets of the others. And it was resulted the humiliation of the others. So therefore, we must avoid such people. We must avoid telling the secrets to such people who are so much talkative. The second factor is when someone is inferiority complex. When someone is in inferiority complex, or he has the inferiority complex. If someone has such a complex, obviously, then because he lacks something, on the other hand, he knew about the secrets of the other, therefore he wants to use those secrets for himself. When someone is sitting somewhere and he is feeling inferiority, then obviously what they do is they start leaking the secrets of the others, and this is not good. So we must avoid these things, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the factors of leaking the secrets of the others. So we mentioned a couple of factors. Now, we want to talk about other factors. One of the factors can be that when someone is angry upon someone and he is so much, we can say like he is emotional. So in those emotions and being angry upon someone, this can cause the leak of a secret that we know from someone. Maybe we want to get empty from what we have, or maybe like the anger that we have, and it is so much that in that anger we might leak. Therefore, we must avoid such things. The very important thing in today's world, the time in which we are living, that is the obviously the communication equipments. These communication equipments, I don't know, the applications, mobile phone, the tablet, maybe the wireless things that we have, all these things are such things that can cause the leak of some, you know, secrets. Even if I'm living in my personal life, maybe I'm sharing my pictures on the Instagram to my family, maybe my Facebook is open, And I have just my family members added on the Facebook. But since it is open, we have seen that it has been showed in different programs. It has been showed on the TV, on the newspaper, maybe over the internet. It is said that there are some people, there are some bad people that who are after your data, and they can access to your computer, to your mobile phone, to your tablet, to your phone, and they're recording your personal pictures, maybe. They're recording your life, they're recording the things that you do not want, and later they're using it against you. Therefore, we must be careful when we are using these communication tools in our life, that we limit the use of them. Maybe when we are in the family, we leave the phone on a side. Maybe when we are on the laptop, so we take care of covering the camera, maybe, or the other things. Obviously, there are different ways the people know it better. But obviously, in today's world, it is very important to be careful if we want to have a peaceful life, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor, and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials. He definitely has the experience, been there in the as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
NGC-23 is a remote galaxy which is more than 200 million light-years away from Earth. What's even more interesting is that the interstellar object was observed by none of the celebrity telescopes like James Webb, but by a new indigenous Iranian observatory called INO, short for Iranian National Observatory, marking a milestone in the country's quest for deep space.
Within 3 weeks ago, which we got the first light, the so-called first light, we had no idea about the quality of the image we are going to get, and it was excellent.
Another debut image shot by the 3.4-meter optical telescope is ARP-282, an interacting galaxy pair located approximately 320 million light-years away. Scientists at the Iranian National Observatory say their telescope could see objects as far as 7 billion light-years away.
Of course, we can use this telescope to observe even deeper objects, but the highest quality of this telescope can be achieved up to 7 billion light-years away from us.
INO is built on Mount Gargash, north of the city of Isfahan, at a height of 3,600 meters above sea level. The project was initiated about 15 years ago, aiming at the development of a medium-class telescope to provide a research facility for national users.
In the next coming months, and especially in the next year, the telescope will be delivered to the astronomers as the end user of this expensive and complex instrument.
Constructing INO was the result of complicated scientific and technological efforts, but there was even a tougher challenge, U.S. sanctions. The anti-Iran measures block high-tech imports and access to foreign know-how. The Iranian team purchased the glass mirror blanks from a German firm, but then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own.
Due to U.S. sanctions and some financial problems, they cut their relation with us, and we did the rest of project within last 12 years by ourselves.
INO is still not fully developed. Engineers need to integrate software, fine-tune the active optics, and install the first science instrument, a high-resolution imaging camera. Once completed, the telescope will help scientists understand galaxy formation and stellar evolution, and hunt for exoplanets.
With INO, Iran has marked its first giant leap in space exploration and has fairly entered the world space race. The telescope's builders are now thrilled to announce that they will soon release more stunning images of deep space, hoping to help the world catch a glimpse of the wonders of our universe. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thousands of mourners took to the streets of Nablus in the occupied West Bank to bid farewell to Palestinians killed by Israeli forces. Early Tuesday, clashes broke out between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces after regime forces conducted a raid in Nablus. Several Palestinians were killed in the raid. Among the victims was Wadi Hawah, a fighter for the newly formed resistance group Lion's Den. 21 other Palestinians were also wounded in the attack, some of them in critical condition.
Those Palestinian young men will not be defeated by the Israeli war machinery. The Israeli occupation will pay a high price for its crimes. The response will be in the field. The flag of Wadi Hawa and other martyrs will continue flying every day, and more Palestinian heroes will be born.
The Israeli army said it had carried out a vast operation with police and intelligence officers targeting a site used by the main operatives of the Lion's Den, describing it as a headquarters and a workshop for making weapons. Later on Tuesday, regime forces conducted another attack near Ramallah and killed one more Palestinian man. 19-year-old Qusay At-Tamimi was killed during a confrontation in the village of Nabi Saleh. Palestinian officials have condemned the raids as vicious and criminal, but they said such attacks will not break the will of the Palestinian people, who are adherent to resistance as their legitimate right.
Their attacks on Palestinians in Nablus and in Ramallah and in other places will not break the Palestinian will. It will not stop the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinians have understood very clearly that Israel understands only the language of force, and that's why they are ready to defend themselves and defend their rights.
All the Palestinians are in the same tunnel, facing the same atrocities, while the same war crimes are being committed all over the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians are unified through different forms of resistance.
Since the beginning of this year, over 130 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
The Israeli regime threatens to continue killing Palestinian resistance fighters under the pretext of battling terrorism. Palestinians, however, say they will remain steadfast in their resolve, stressing that the Israeli atrocities will not stop their resistance. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The 18th General Assembly of the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies gathered up members of the media entity in Tehran to discuss new trends in news production and explore areas of cooperation between its members.
So basically, OAN has now become somewhat of a center of world-balanced approach to journalism. Nowadays, it's quite difficult to find media companies outside of Asia and Africa who are looking for a balanced approach to news. Basically, a lot of the major media companies of the world have decided to play only for one side.
I'm from Lebanon's state news agency. I believe this summit provides a platform for media diplomacy between the member news agencies to reach common grounds on world affairs.
OANA currently has 43 members from 35 countries, covering two-thirds of the world's population. As a member, the Islamic Republic News Agency, or shortly IRNA, is hosting this year's General Assembly, based on a voting that took place during the 17th OANA Summit in Seoul, South Korea.
Today is a good opportunity for the representatives of prominent news agencies present in Tehran for the OANA meeting to observe the conditions in Iran. An independent media current is needed to disseminate the realities.
Formed in 1961 on UNESCO's initiative, the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies is an association of news agencies from UNESCO member states in the Asia-Pacific region. OANA provides a newswire service containing articles provided by its members. Aside from IRNA, Iran's Fars News and Mehr News agencies are also among OANA members.
Delegates here say OANA's main goal is to break the Western monopoly on media and to present an alternative narrative on regional and global developments, as opposed to, quote, the narrative offered by mainstream media. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Russian flag now flies over Donetsk. As Russia claims this region is now part of the Russian Federation, the streets in the center are quiet. As Ukraine continues to bomb the city, the front line is only 6 kilometers away. In order to find out how people here feel about their new identity, I headed down the road to the adjoining city of Makiivka. There are more people on the streets, as it's safer here.
We are very happy. We've been waiting for it for a long time. We're very glad. All acquaintances, neighbors, all people surrounding me are grateful to Russia.
It's a complicated question. After everything that's been going on, it can be no other way now. There is no other way but to be with Russia. We were close people always. We couldn't be divided. We lived quite okay in Ukraine, but it's no longer Ukraine. Their authorities are not Ukrainian anymore.
This is a common sentiment in Donbass, that they were happy being part of Ukraine, but when the nationalists came to power in 2014 and began discriminating against Russian culture and bombing civilians here, they turned toward Russia.
We have been waiting for it. Donbass was eager to become part of Russia. We have the same values, culture, and now that we are part of Russia, we can be ourselves.
I'll tell the truth. While they've been shelling us and we were living in fear, in Kiev, they were enjoying themselves. Nobody in Kiev paid any attention. There are people there who support and understand us, but they cannot speak about it. They can be killed or imprisoned by the SBU for this. We're not against Ukrainian civilians. We are Ukrainian people too. I have relatives there. We have pity for people in Kiev, but nobody's killing them there on purpose.
Thousands have been killed by Ukrainian shelling over the last 8 years here. Hardly a day goes by without more civilians dying. Most of the anger I hear, though, is directed at the Ukrainian government, not its people.
I sympathize with them very much. I am always against people being killed, but it's war. Nothing can be done about it. They're killing us and we have to defend ourselves. Sometimes we had to hide in basements because of shelling. I work at school. Our school was under shelling. The windows were smashed. It's very scary.
Now, doing vox pops in cities on issues around the world, you usually get a variety of opinions. Not so here. Everybody I've spoken to says they want to join Russia. The only difference of opinion seems to be just how much sympathy they have for people in Kiev now living under shelling themselves. The people here have been doing so for the last 8 years. While the southern regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson are more mixed, for peace to come, it's clear the world needs to accept that the vast majority of people in Donbass no longer want to be part of Ukraine. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
It's taken him a few weeks longer than anticipated, but former Chancellor Rishi Sunak is now the leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister-elect of the UK, and of course, the first ethnic minority to hold either position. In a rather stage-managed affair, Sunak made his first public address to the nation.
But there is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity, and I will make it my utmost priority to bring our party and our country together. Rishi,
you have raised... Sunak had been the favoured candidate with fellow MPs in the leadership contest held in the summer, but had to settle for runner-up spot. This after Liz Truss won the vote of the Tory party members. This time, MPs saw to it that this was an internal matter, with voters looking on as yet another Conservative MP was anointed.
We had Johnston, we had Liz Truss very briefly, and now we have Sunak. Ordinary people in Britain have got no say over who becomes Prime Minister. That is a democratic deficit, and I think it sticks in the throats of many, many people in this country.
Sunak was keen to emphasise unity and stability, but those might be wishful ideas for a party that's literally at war with itself.
But there's been so much infighting within inside the Conservative Party, it's very difficult to see how they can all just lay down their knives and be friends again. Now, obviously, the sight of Labour running ahead, well ahead in the opinion polls will unite them. They're not lemmings, they don't want to commit suicide. That's why there won't be an election soon.
Prime Minister. Sunak's leadership will be tested by the presence of figures like former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who claimed to have had the support to run for high office, but conceded now was not the right time for his return. How can Sunak ensure he doesn't follow the Liz Truss path to political collapse?
For many, the British premiership is a poison chalice. With the country facing one of the worst cost of living crises in a generation, with, of course, more austerity measures bound to be implemented and a political landscape more divided than ever, the new occupants of Downing Street face a Herculean task to try and pull Britain back from the brink.
Amina Taylor, London.
Oh.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations. And this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity. For example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is set to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along.
Europe, they are totally dependent on the United States and in energy field and in military field. And that is dependency that doesn't allow them to conduct independent foreign policies.
Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand.
There's a lot of work now ahead of us what the energy is concerned, but the roadmap is very clear. And it was good to have this unanimity, this broad support for the roadmap that we have put forward.
Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide 18 billion euro to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It's no land at the heart of a scorching but amazing island. Nowtown is one of the latest entertainment centers in Iran's Kish Island in the Persian Gulf. Every year, some 2 million visitors from inside and outside Iran visit the island to enjoy its attractions, from its entertainment centers to its stunning beach.
The beach and the pier in Kish are really peaceful and tranquilizing. It's the third time I'm visiting the island, and I went parasailing, water skiing, and I'm planning to go scuba diving.
Kish Island offers all kinds of sea entertainment activities, from scuba diving to sailing, and oh yes, flyboarding. Besides sea sports, visitors can enjoy its amusement parks and a range of leisure activities inside the island. And if you're a tireless window shopper, Kish is a land of malls and shopping centers.
Kish is an amazing island. It used to be an abandoned island some 3 decades ago, but today it is a luxurious tourist resort with modern buildings and exciting recreational places.
Despite all the pleasure one can have in Kish, the island still has many shortcomings. The major issue annoying visitors is the poor accommodation services.
Hotel facilities and services are a bit weak given the large number of tourists that visit this island. They need to pay more attention to the accommodation infrastructure.
Just a few hundred kilometers away from Kish, there's a tourist magnet in the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, which absorbs the chunk of foreign tourists. While U.S. sanctions on Iran are a major factor to blame for Kish lagging behind in its rivalry with Dubai, the island's officials believe it still has a chance to win the game of tourism against Dubai.
If we want to excel, it is not going to be a tough job. We need to work on two major areas. The first is the infrastructure, and the second is regulations that would allow tourists or investors to easily come to Kish to entertain themselves or do business.
Situated off the southern coast of Iran in the Persian Gulf, Kish is one of Iran's free trade zones. Foreign travelers do not need a visa to visit the island, as travel permits are issued on arrival by Kish officials and are valid for up to 14 days.
With its mesmerizing nature and eye-catching urban landscapes, Kish has earned the title of the Bride of the Persian Gulf. Its authorities say the island is already a hub for Iranian travelers, but they say they seek to turn it into a regional tourist magnet. Yusuf Jalalip from Kish Island.
analysis of recent events in Iran. In this program, we look at how Western governments have planned to stoke unrest in Iran, doing everything in their power to encourage rioting in the country. Please stay with us. Recent events in Iran have become a pretext for Western governments to interfere in Iran's internal affairs and to pour fuel on the fire of unrest in the country. During the past 43 years, the enemies of the Islamic Revolution have used all opportunities and all means at their disposal to attempt to oust the Islamic Republic. In addition to the policy of promoting Iranophobia, both within the region and the wider world, they have also tried to smear the Islamic Republic, sullying Iran's reputation and portraying a very negative image of Iran through the media outlets that they control. It is obvious that the United States of America, Canada and Britain, and some other European countries are trying to bring about a velvet revolution or a colored revolution in the Islamic Republic, doing everything they can to cause unrest in the country. The enemies of Islam have used all sorts of pretexts and all manner of techniques to create a crisis within the country, including defending women's rights, human rights, how elections are held, the vetting of candidates, and creating doubt with regards to how votes are counted or tallied. Anything which can be used to split the population or create divisions and discord among the people is fair game, as far as the enemies of Iran are concerned. All these techniques and many more have been used at some point during the past 43 years to generate unrest within the Islamic Republic. The enemies are constantly watching out for an opportunity to present itself to stoke more riots and demonstrations. They plan meticulously for the next riot in Iran. Virtually all democratic nations face demonstrations and unrest, usually caused by the poor economic performance of their government, or soaring prices and soaring inflation, which outstrip wage increases quite easily, or rising unemployment, etc. But these demonstrations and protests are usually handled quite well and governments respond to the demands of their people. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the most democratic country in the West Asia region. In the first year after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, no less than 5 elections and referendums were held, with the Iranian people casting their ballots in the ballot box at least 5 times in less than a year. The first of these was a national referendum on the type of government and governing system that we should have. The second was a nationwide election to determine the members of the Assembly of Experts of the Constitution. The third was a national referendum on a draft constitution drawn up for the Islamic Republic. The fourth was a nationwide presidential election. And the fifth was a nationwide parliamentary election to elect members of the Iranian parliament, the Majlis. It is worth noting the unprecedented nature of the first referendum in post-Islamic Revolution Iran. In no other revolution in the world's history have the people been asked to vote in a national referendum to determine the type of government and the type of governing system that they should have just 50 days after the victory of the revolution. The democratic credentials of the Islamic Republic are quite clear. In the 43 years which have passed since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, more than 40 nationwide elections have been held in the Islamic Republic. Few countries can match this level of participation by the general public in the running of their country. But it is also worth noting that some of the least democratic countries of the world are also